Prelude, Fugue and Riffs by Leonard Bernstein. Benny Goodman was the clarinetist with the Columbia Jazz Combo, directed by the composer. And you can catch more Bernstein later today, his symphonic dances from West Side Story, a part of tonight's concert from the Bridgewater Hall, Manchester, with the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra and Marin Alsop. Also on the programme, Clarice Assad's Terra Brasilis Fantasia on the Brazilian National Anthem and Mahler's First Symphony. Tom Redman presents Live in Concert from 7:30 this evening. And Michael Collins will be live on In Tune tomorrow, both playing and talking about his upcoming concert with the London Symphonia. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've enjoyed it, and thank you so much for listening. Next week, I have a Telemann cantata lined up, a spicy harpsichord concerto by Manuel de Falla, and between 10 and 11, remembering a middle-hour feature from earlier in the year that seemed to go down very well with many of you. I have a sequence I'm calling Towards the Apocalypse, a second visit to the Second Viennese School, including a matchless recording of Berg's violin concerto with Christian Ferris as soloist. So please do join me, same time, 9 o'clock next Sunday morning, here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Unquenchable high spirits perform this evening at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall, live here on Radio 3 by Ville de Franc.
One of the big stars of the 2013 BBC Proms, the violinist Ville de Franc, returns to BBC Radio 3 with a live concert from London's Royal Festival Hall.
Back comes Ville de Franc.
She plays Prokofiev's second violin concerto, and there's more Prokofiev from the Philharmonia and conductor Yuri Temyakanov as the concert opens with the composer's classical symphony. Thursday nights, Radio 3 live in concert, starting at 7:30.
Well, now it's time for Private Passions, which was recorded yesterday at Sage Gateshead as part of Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival. Michael Barclay's guest is the former MP and political diarist Chris Mullin.
Welcome to Sage Gateshead for this special edition of Private Passions. We're here as part of Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival, and my guest, Chris Mullin, is certainly a free thinker. In three volumes of political diaries, he's given us a sharp and very funny account of the workings of Westminster from his vantage point as Labour MP for Sunderland South. He's also written thrillers, one of which was made into a television series, and, of course, a book about his successful campaign to release the Birmingham Six. Let's start with the diaries, Chris. They'll be, I think, a treasure trove for future historians, the daily gossip and manoeuvring of those in power, the tea room gossip, the deals behind closed doors. I wonder how you actually did it. I mean, were you secretly scribbling away while people were talking?
Well, not while they were actually talking, but I used to carry, I don't have one in my pocket at the moment, I don't keep a diary anymore, as it happens, a little red notebook. And when something interesting occurred, or there was some interesting snatch of dialogue, I noted it down. And then I typed them up at the end of the week, and Bob's your uncle.
But when your fellow MPs found out you were keeping a diary, did they start to treat you differently or start to tell you things they wanted to see in the diary?
Well, that's, yes, indeed. That was most interesting. You know, when a politician goes into a bookshop, goes to the politics section, the first thing he or she does is run their finger down the index to see where their name is. And, you know, when Paddy Ashdown was signing copies of his diaries for a Liberal MP called Don Foster. And, of course, Don went home and did exactly that. And when he got to his name in the index, Paddy had written in the margin, "Hi, Don, I thought you'd look here first."
So, 23 years as an MP, Chris, and your first choice of music is actually a sort of souvenir of those years in Parliament, because it's the Parliament Choir singing Mozart. Now, there may be people here who didn't realise that there is, in fact, a Parliament Choir.
Yes, it's a wonderful democratic organisation because anybody who works in the Palace of Westminster is eligible to be a member. So you've got members of Parliament in the Commons and the Lords, alongside doorkeepers and people from the cafeteria, people from all walks of life in the Palace of Westminster.
So music becomes a great leveller.
Oh, but it seems to in this case, yes. And they also get to play in some wonderful venues because they've obviously got a bit of influence. So I've heard concerts in the Banqueting Hall in Whitehall, in Westminster Cathedral, in Westminster Abbey, and in the Cadogan Hall on Sloane Square.
And they do some wonderful music, like this Mozart that you've chosen first.
They certainly do, yes. It's extremely difficult because quite a few of them are very busy people, and then they team up, usually on the day itself, with an orchestra that they haven't met before necessarily, and they have one rehearsal in the afternoon, and on the night it all seems to go all right, at least to my untutored ear, but it seems to me a white-knuckle approach.
Let's hear the results. The Parliament Choir singing part of Mozart's Coronation Mass. We heard professional soloists Flora McIntosh, Nicola Dunn, Nathan Vale and Jonathan Pugsley, accompanied by the South Bank Sinfonia, conducted by Simon over. The next music rather captures up your time at a Catholic boarding school in Ipswich, and I think it's where you first encountered it, in fact.
Yeah, it's probably the first classical music I ever encountered. No, I went to a strict regime Catholic boarding school in Ipswich, run by the De La Celle brothers. There was one of them, a bit of a tyrant, called Brother Solomon, who was friendly with Peter Catin, the famous pianist. And so Peter Catin used to come occasionally and play. Attendance was not voluntary. We were all sort of marched in and had to sit in silence. And actually, of course, he was a brilliant musician, and I don't suppose I appreciated it then as much as I do now. But I thought, since it was almost certainly the first classical music that I was aware of, we ought to have a piece of Peter Catin's music.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll hear him playing a Chopin nocturne. And nice to think that your attendance saved you from encountering the wisdom of Solomon.
Thank you.
Chopin's Nocturne in B-flat minor, opus 9, played by Peter Katie. After university, Chris Mullin, you began as a journalist, didn't you? And you joined, I think, the Daily Mirror training scheme.
Yes.
And as an early example of your profound independence of mind, no sooner had you finished this course and been offered a job than you turned it down and took off.
Yeah, I paid 80... I was offered a job on the Sunday Mirror, and I didn't think it was my sort of thing, so I paid £81 for a one-way ticket to the Far East and spent 8 months sort of working backwards.
And didn't you encounter the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, I spent a bit of time in the Himalayas in 1972, and I went to see the Dalai Lama of Tibet, who lives in Dharamsala in northern India, who I've got to know reasonably well in subsequent years, but at that time it was my first encounter with him. I've got to say he's one of my heroes, really. I don't have many heroes, but he's, like all the greatest men, he's an extremely modest man, and he's kept a flag flying for his unique civilization for more than 50 years in the face of great provocation. I'd been in China before that, and China was closed, really, at that time, and so we got on quite well because I could give him a first-hand account of where we'd been and what we'd seen. And I went with a couple of French journalists who I met in Dharamsala. They were a bit of a pain because the Dalai Lama and I would be having a serious conversation, and the French journalist would intervene every so often and say, "Your Holiness, I am a Frenchman. What do you think of General de Gaulle?" The Dalai Lama would say, "General de Gaulle, great man." And then we'd carry on talking about interesting things. And then the French journalist would pipe up again, "Your Holiness, I am a Frenchman. What do you think of France? France, great country." and so on. But I've met him on many subsequent occasions. And, of course, once I was in Parliament, he came to visit Britain every couple of years, and I took him to see the Foreign Secretary and the Shadow Foreign Secretary over the years and presided at one or two events at which he was taking part.
People speak of him as sort of imparting a rather extraordinary kind of presence. I mean, the kind of experience some people get from the arts, from music almost, that they feel that they are finding not some kind of spiritual, something that emanates from him. Do you find that?
Yes, and I'm sure that's certainly true, especially those who are into Tibet and Tibetan mysticism and so forth. Well, actually, he's a rather down-to-earth guy, very informal, good sense of humour.
Let's hear some music from there. One of the things that I love about Private Passions is that we don't just get the great classics, but people bring in music from different cultures, and this is music from Tibet, isn't it?
The music from Tibet tends to be very haunting because we're talking about a landscape that is, on average, 12,000 feet above sea level, very barren landscape. It's very sparsely inhabited, 2 or 3 million people living in an area the size of Western Europe. And, of course, it tends on the whole, though this is not, I think, to be very religious. A lot of it's actually religious chanting and can get a little bit tedious. But I've taken a great interest in Tibet during the last 30 or 40 years, and so it's been a part of my life, so I thought we ought to have a piece of Tibetan music.
Makara, or The Goddess of Fortune, sung by Anichoing Drolma with Steve Tibbetts accompanying. Coming back to England, Chris Mullin, you began working properly as a journalist, as opposed to improperly earlier, and a journalist with a real cause, to reveal that a number of the men imprisoned as IRA bombers during the mid-70s were in fact innocent, and that the real bombers were still at large. And you turned detective to find the real bombers, putting yourself in situations of some personal danger. And I wonder whether you look back on that as some real crowning achievement in your life, because it wasn't just that you freed them, but that it made people look at these cases in future with a bit more caution.
Well, the good thing about all that, they got the wrong people for all the big IRA bombings of the mid-1970s, a total of 18 altogether. And, of course, 10 of whom would have hanged had we still had the death penalty, incidentally. And, of course, that produced an enormous shock to the British legal system, which was, until that time, one of the smuggest in the world. And it did cause some of them, not all of them, I still meet people who are in denial today, in very senior positions, but it caused certainly the government of the day and some people at the top of the legal profession to reflect. And it led to a Royal Commission, and it led to some serious changes. It led to the setting up of the Criminal Cases Review Commission now, which examines alleged miscarriages of justice, and it's led to the quashing of a large number of convictions over the years.
Were you quite nervous when you were doing this sort of undercover work in Ireland?
Well, if you were sort of on a sort of rundown council estate in Dublin and you were four stories up and all you could see around you was concrete and you rang a doorbell and someone opened the door and you said, "Hi, my name's Chris Mullin. I've come to talk to you about your role in the Birmingham pub bombings," you couldn't always be sure of the reception you'd receive.
Well, actually, your account of that is quite extraordinary in your book, and I very much enjoyed reading it. One supplementary question there. Do you feel that that case, you mentioned they could have hung, is just in itself, I mean, just that one argument about we could hang the wrong people, is that in itself an argument not to have a death penalty for you?
Well, it's the bottom line, isn't it? I think there's all sorts of other reasons, the general barbarity involved, but that's the bottom line, really, if you don't buy any of the other arguments. Michael Howard, who was the Home Secretary and had been in favour of the death penalty, said in Parliament that he'd changed his mind as a result of the Birmingham Six case.
So coming into politics, Chris, you worked as an MP for 23 years, and you've said that your most enjoyable years were in the Foreign Office as Africa Minister. That's rather nice, because the next choice is a traditional Zulu song, and I think it's sung by your daughter, Emma's choir.
Yes, it wasn't Emma's choir. It's sung by the Hillview Junior School Choir. They had a wonderful music teacher called Joanna Jackson, and every year in Sunderland there's a competition amongst all the choirs from all the primary schools to decide who's the best. And that year, the Hillview School Choir, in which my daughter was a member, won, and it's a traditional African song. There's wonderful music in Africa, wonderful.
Bye.
Waya Ngena, sung by Hillview Junior School Choir, directed by Joanna Jackson, a traditional Zulu song. I'm very struck by the way Africa gives or gave you a perspective on everyday life in Westminster. There's one entry in your diaries from June 1994, Chris, and I'm wondering if I could ask you to read it.
On the train, I read a shocking article about a new famine in Ethiopia. I find myself wondering whether I wouldn't be more used to the world if I worked for an aid agency instead of being a minor politician, ministering to the generally sullen and relatively prosperous. I am entirely useless. Must have been a Monday morning, that, I think.
It was a Monday morning.
Very good.
But it is extraordinary, isn't it, how we take for granted everything that we can do, whether it's flushing a lavatory or running a tap, and then you go to somewhere like that, and I've been to, where you see they have nothing, but literally nothing. If they're lucky, a bit of polythene over their head. And you can't help but be affected by that.
But what's remarkable is, I remember in Sierra Leone, which is a country devastated by a civil war, and there's all these little tin shacks on the hill going up behind the Freetown, the capital, and they don't have running water and perhaps not electricity, I don't know. But out of those little tin shacks, every day come two or three little people, immaculate school uniforms, beautifully clean, their little satchels, walking along the road to school, and it's so moving to see that. And you think how their mother must struggle to produce that result every day, to look after her children in that way, in those circumstances. And how would we manage if we were in the same condition?
Next, Mozart and another mass. And I think this was used for the television version of your thriller, A Very British Coup.
Yes, that's right. Yes, 30 years ago, I wrote a novel called A Very British Coup. It's about an attempt by the British establishment and the Americans to overthrow a left-wing government led by a steelworker called Harry Perkins. And in 1988, it was made into what turned out to be a very successful television series starring a great actor called Ray McAnally. And the theme tune was the credo from the Great Mass.
This is Mozart's C minor mass, and interesting to think that Mozart wrote this really for his fiancée, Constanze, and was hoping that it could be used when he brought his wife to Vienna.
Thank you.
Music from Mozart's C minor Mass. We heard Christiane Oelzer, Jennifer Larmor, Scott Weir, Peter Cui, and Collegium Vocale, accompanied by La Chapelle Royale and the Orchestre des Champs-Élysées. The conductor was Philippe Herrewegger. Well, Chris Mullen, I've now got a surprise for you, because I've chosen something which might bring a little smile to your lips. It's to do with that thriller, A Very British Coup, and it's what your hero plays when he's trying to seduce women. It's a Handel organ concerto, and it works every time. And while you listen to it, I want you to decide whether here in Gateshead this would work on you. The Allegro from Handel's Organ Concerto No. 9 in B-flat. Alleluia! We heard Simon Preston playing the organ and the Menuhin Festival Orchestra, conducted by Yehudi Menuhin himself. Now, I'm going to ask you, if that would have worked for you, whether, rather than raising anything else, you raise your hand. Anybody feel that that would be a seductive introduction?
Well, it worked for Harry Perkins, my Prime Minister, but I'm not sure it ever...
it's rather fortunate that we covered that question of seduction, Chris, because the next music is very much to do with your wife, isn't it? It's from Vietnam.
Yep, Vietnam's played quite a large part in my life. Well, of course, like many young people who got involved in politics in the 60s, the Vietnam War was a very big political issue, and in the early 70s I went there as a journalist, actually for the Daily Telegraph magazine. Then, after the war was over, in about 1980, when I was increasingly unemployable as a freelance journalist, a friend of mine ran a travel agency down in Bristol that did the first British tours to Vietnam, and he asked me to be the courier, and my wife was the Vietnamese courier at the other end. That's how we met.
And this music, which is played, by the way, on the Dan Bao, a one-stringed instrument developed by farmers using the baskets they strapped to their backs. And the wind would blow through the strings of the basket. I really love this poetic story. And make a sound. So people began to make a version of the instrument using silk threads and bamboo. And this is what it sounds like.
Thank you.
Don't you think it's extraordinary when you hear something like that, all the Tibetan music, where even though we may not understand it, we're beguiled by what appears to have its own integrity in some way?
Yes, very graceful music, that, isn't it? And I think it does kind of reflect the Vietnamese character. It's played by a young chap called Huy Ostrom Muller. When I knew Huy, first of all, he was 9 or 10 years old, and he was very poor. He was the son of one of my wife's colleagues in the Saigon Tourist. They lived in one large room in a crumbling colonial house packed with a lot of families. The toilet was on an outside balcony, and a large curtain divided the room, and another family lived behind the curtain until the floor collapsed, after which they didn't. And we grew up to be a very talented musician, and that is taken from a CD that he recorded.
You see, I think I was talking about integrity in music, and it seems to me something which we perhaps overlook, particularly when we have at our disposal, not only the kind of riches that we've talked about, you know, running water and all that kind of thing, but in terms of instruments, you know, we could have full orchestras, and yet so often in art, less is more. I mean, a sketch sometimes speaks more loudly than an oil painting. And there, where you had a one-string instrument, and somehow it had its own power, because you have to be even more inventive. It pushes you, it stretches you.
Of course, that reflects life in Vietnam as it was when it was quiet and calm and 80% rural. Today, it's been hit by a form of market forces so virulent that not even Mrs. Thatcher would recognise them. And it's pretty chaotic. You don't hear a lot of that music around, except in concert halls, of course.
That was a folk song from South Vietnam, performed by Huy Ostrom Muller. This edition of Private Passions is being recorded at BBC Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival at Sage Gateshead. Now, you love this part of the country, Chris, and in fact you've chosen to retire in Northumberland. What is it about the landscape and the people that so attracts you?
Well, I lived in Sunderland for 25 years. I still have a home there, though I'm in the process of moving to the north of Northumberland. Great thing about living in this in the northeast of England is that you don't have to go on holiday more than about 2 or 3 hours' drive from home. You've got the lakes 2 hours to the west, you've got the North York Moors an hour and a half to the south, and you've got the north of Northumberland and the Scottish borders an hour and a half to the north. And it's always been my ambition to live in a beautiful part of Northumberland, in a walled garden. And since somebody but it kindly, for the second time, bought the film rights on a very British coup, I've been able to purchase a small walled garden in a very beautiful valley in a remote part of Northumberland. And now I'm going to fade away growing vegetables.
I'm sure you won't fade away, but we were talking about the simplicity of that single-string instrument. And what I love about the next piece is that here is a sort of absolutely of-the-earth instrument that comes from this part of the world. It's the Northumbrian pipes. Have you ever tried to blow through them?
I certainly haven't. Well, you play them with your hands, no, I certainly haven't. No, very, very tricky. You need to be very dexterous to do it.
You have to fill the bellows, don't you, with your hands?
I don't know, but I assume... I defer to you on matters...
I think much better
to do with musical instruments.
Much better to defer to Catherine Tickell, most wonderful player, and indeed won the Queen's Medal for Music a couple of years ago. So here she is playing Arcade. Catherine de Kell with our Kate. And actually, it was written for another famous Kate from the Northeast, Catherine Cookson. And Catherine de Kell will be performing later this evening as part of this festival, Free Thinking. This is, as I said, a free thinking festival. And given the life you've led, I wonder whether you've come to any sort of conclusion about life or life and politics or things that you feel you might like to float in this arena, things that, you know, you've begun to feel even more passionately about, perhaps, as you look back.
Gosh, I think I'd require notice of that of that question. I think the thing, although we complain about our politicians, and rightly so very often, I think the thing that we don't always reflect upon enough is that we have the good fortune to live in one of the most prosperous countries in the world, where we take it for granted that if we flick a switch, electricity comes on, we turn on a tap, clean water comes out, where we have universal healthcare and universal education up to the age of 16 or 17. And it's only when you start to travel to other countries that you realise quite how fortunate we are. And you often see interviews with people, usually vox pops. There was actually a series on Radio 4 about politics, and it began with a series of vox pops in which people were asked what they think of politicians, and the answers were uniformly negative, and usually one or two words. They were never really challenged as to the basis of their opinions. What's politics ever done for you was the next question, and again the answer was nothing, nothing at all, nothing, you all useless. Well, hang on a minute, as I say, we're in a country with universal free health, education, all the things I just mentioned. There is a connection between those things and the political process, and perhaps a lot of people don't appreciate that because nowadays we take them for granted.
And when you are in your garden reflecting on your life, and particularly your political life, how do you see ambition? Is that something which is a curse?
It's perfectly honourable and reasonable to have ambition, whatever walk of life you happen to be in, but not, obviously, at the expense of other people. I personally went into politics because I wanted to make the world a better place and had the arrogance or conceit to believe that I might have a contribution to make. Now, whether I did or not, it's for others to judge, but that's what motivated me. I think it's what motivated many of my colleagues. So there's nothing wrong with ambition in a good cause. It's only a problem when it becomes overweening and you start to tread on other people.
I'd like, as we come to the end of the programme, Chris, to play you out on an anthem which possibly sums up your philosophy, but it's also, I know, something that means as much to you as any other piece of music, if not more, because it sets the words, "You can't always get what you want."
Well, this is the point at which I am revealed as a total fraud, because I actually spend most of my time not listening to improving music of the sort we have heard earlier, but to the Stones and the Eagles. And so I thought, I don't know whether this is a first, but I thought we might have a Stones a record on Radio 3. Is that a first for Radio 3?
No, it's certainly not. We're a very eclectic church, well, I must admit. I think one of the nice things about having you, Chris Mullin, at a free-thinking festival was that you were able to take a slightly different line to some of our guests who are completely passionate about music in the way that you're passionate about the Stones and the Eagles. But the interesting thing about...
That's damning with faint praise, isn't it?
Yes. But the interesting thing about this particular recording is that it's a marriage, isn't it? Because it actually has a choir as well as the Stones.
Well, because it was Radio 3.
So there was a small concession.
I did happen to know that this You Can't Always Get What You Want, which I think is about 7 minutes long, has the Bach Choir in the background. And I thought if, given that it had the Bach Choir, we'd probably get away with it.
Well, I'm going to ask the audience to say thank you very much, Chris Mullin, as we play the music out. We'll hear the Stones and the Bach Choir. And once again, Chris Mullin, thank you very much.
lovely reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find. Get my fair share of abuse. Singing words gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50 amp fuse. Sing it to me. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. Just my fine. You get what you need. Oh, baby, yeah. Oh. I went down to the Chelsea drugstore to get your prescription filled. I was standing in line with Mr. Jimmy. A man, did he look pretty ill? We decided that we would have a soda. My favorite flavor, cherry red. I sung my song to Mr. Jimmy. Yeah, and he said one word to me, and that was there. I said to him, you can't always.
Rolling Stones and the Bach Choir, ending this week's edition of Private Passions, recorded at the Sage in Gateshead. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. Next week, Michael Barclay's guest is the novelist Roddy Doyle, and we'll be returning to the Freethinking Festival in Gateshead at 4 o'clock this afternoon for the choir. Very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, another visit to the 2010 City of London Festival for string quartets by Villa-Lobos and Mendelssohn. And then at 2 o'clock, Lucy Skeeping is here with the early music show. It's now coming up to 2 minutes past one. Time here on BBC Radio 3 for the latest news, read by David Cornett.
A wave of bombings has killed at least 50 people in Iraq and wounded many others. 10 car bombs went off in mainly Shiite Muslim areas in and around Baghdad. A busy market and a bus station were among the targets. The level of violence in Iraq is at its worst for more than 5 years, with at least 400 people killed so far this month alone. Syria has handed over a detailed plan for the destruction of its chemical weapons. International weapons inspectors conclude their work inside the country today. Weather forecasters are warning that many parts of England and Wales will face the worst storms in 5 years tonight. Winds of more than 80 miles an hour are expected and up to 2 inches of rain overnight. Along some coasts, waves could be as high as 30 feet. The Prime Minister says he's spoken to the various government agencies and departments responsible for ensuring that people are protected from the adverse weather. The Conservative Party chairman, Grant Shapps, has said the BBC must be more open about its operations, or it could face a cut in the licence fee. The former Director General, Greg Dyke, has dismissed the comments as a bid to put pressure on the corporation with an election looming. The president of the Association of Chief Police Officers, Sir Hugh Orde, has said the three police officers accused of giving a misleading account of a meeting with the former Cabinet Minister Andrew Mitchell should have apologised to him. They've denied giving a deliberately misleading account of the meeting in Sutton Coldfield last October. Their chief constables appeared before a committee of MPs last week and did apologise to Mr Mitchell. Sebastian Vettel has won the Indian Grand Prix, securing his fourth successive world championship title. At 26, he's the youngest driver to secure four titles in a row. And the weather, there'll be sunny spells and scattered showers for most of this afternoon, with strong winds and a possibility of more heavy rain, with a risk of thunder in the north and west. And overnight, as we know, heavy rain and gales will spread across many parts of England and Wales. BBC News and weather at 4 minutes past one.
David Cornett, thank you very much. So to today's lunchtime concert here on BBC Radio 3, a recording from the City of London Festival in the summer of 2010. Some of our new generation artists at the time, the Elias Quartet, will be ending this concert with a particularly raw and passionate rendition of Mendelssohn's final string quartet, number 6 in F minor, written after the death of his sister Fanny. But they begin the concert in a more light-hearted vein, reflecting the 2010 festival's theme of music from the Portuguese-speaking world, with a string quartet by Villa-Lobos, which he wrote in 1915, the first of 17 quartets that he was to compose over a period of 42 years. The Elias Quartet's second violinist, Donald Grant, introduced the piece to the audience in the church.
This particular quartet started out life as a three-movement suite, and then extended it to 6 movements and named it a string quartet. But it does actually have the feel still of a suite of music. The movements are all very short, there's some dances, and there's a very strong folky feel to the music. You can really hear Brazil coming across. When we've been rehearsing it, we've said it's the kind of music we can imagine if we were out one hot summer's night in Brazil, sitting on a balcony having dinner, and we can imagine the musicians kind of around us playing this. So this is his first quartet.